the Bahamas, the search for loved ones after Hurricane Dorian continues online. And in Moscow, voters head to the polls to elect citywide officials, but the ballot is missing more than 200 names.
We hope for the liberation of Russia from these people. We want peace and liberation for our city.
We also remember today African strongman Robert Mugabe.
I used to travel with him around the world, and I also remember him for his cruelty towards me in particular, and the number of people who have died because of his obsession with power.
And if you're in Europe, say goodbye to that. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. All week, we've been following the slow, violent path of Hurricane Dorian. Today, it continued battering the Carolinas. It's now heading up our way to Massachusetts with rain and wind gusts up to 60 miles per hour. But that is minor compared to what hit the Bahamas. The picture of the devastation is hard to wrap your head around. Towns look like they were bombed. Thousands are homeless, and dozens of people have lost their lives. Officials in the Bahamas fear the number of dead will soar.
We expect the numbers to be staggering.
As for the missing, people are looking for relatives and loved ones at the website Dorian People Search. It's being run by Vanessa Pritchard Ansel from the capital Nassau, where she lives and works. We caught up with her earlier today. Hi, it's Marco Werman in Boston. Lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm a bag of emotions. So actually, it's really hard to answer that. But you know, I'm located on New Providence. We barely got a surface scratch. We got some winds here and some rain, and there was some flooding. But when you look at the big picture, it's nothing in comparison to what our northern family, being Abacos and Grand Bahama, endured and are still very much enduring. I have nothing to complain about, really.
Well, you created, Vanessa, the website DorianPeopleSearch.com. What was the need that you identified to build this site, and how are people using it?
It was a Sunday night. I was sitting on my couch, and the storm was hitting. It was really the first night that darkness would have fallen on Abaco. And I realized, or I saw on various social media pages, people asking for the whereabouts of their loved ones that were in the path of Dorian. And I realized there was no central location for a place where people can go and ask this.
Who is actually listing the missing persons? Are these people who are trying to find their loved ones?
These are people who are trying to find their loved ones. There is the ability to also input a person in as critical evacuation. We have streamlined our communications with the Canadian consulate here in the Bahamas, as well as the American embassy here in the Bahamas. When someone is marked as critical evacuation, we ask for their nationality. Those embassies and consulates now get an automatic email, so that allows us a faster response time in terms of evacuation.
What have you compiled in terms of sheer numbers? Like, how many people are listed as missing?
So you're the first news outlet that I'm sharing real-time data with, because we're now in the position really to do that. So we have 6,714 entries as of, I want to say, 15 minutes ago.
Right, and we're recording this midday Eastern time, so those numbers might change.
Exactly.
As for the list of people on your website who need evacuation, some of them need really fast evacuation. And there are some really kind of nail-biting stories of people with medical conditions like diabetes who are stuck without medication, not to mention food and water. There's one post I was reading about a family with children. They've been stuck in a van for several days.
I know.
What other stories have stuck with you, Vanessa?
I'm a mother. I'm a mother of a 10-month-old. And there is one in particular of a mother with a 3-month-old. Her house was filling up like a glass of water and going over the brim. And she had to swim from one house to the next with her 3-month-old in her arms. And when you start to think about not having being able to use your arms and only being able to use your legs. And those are the images that are playing out before I go to sleep at night, except that mother and that daughter are me. That's me and my daughter, Isla. And so you begin to think of how you can prepare for a storm. You know, I even thought of like, I need to, when I next, the next hurricane that's coming, I need to have a baby carrier just so then I can put Isla into a baby carrier and I will have use of my arms.
So Vanessa, you're a real estate agent in the Bahamas. It sounds like you've pivoted full time to a new role. How much of your time are you spending on all this? And are you getting any help from volunteers?
The Bahamas has been my home. I was born and raised here, but it is very much a big part of my identity. My family have been here since the 1700s.
Wow.
So a part of my identity is bruised. It's bruised and broken. And so I think it's only natural for me to drop what I was doing to answer, to help out our northern neighbors. But something like this should have been created before disaster struck. We've seen the fires in the California. We've seen Hurricane Katrina. We've seen the typhoons in the Philippines. This is something that all governments should have ready to be deployed the moment disaster strikes.
Vanessa Pritchard-Ansel, she started the website DorianPeopleSearch.com to help find and rescue people in the areas of the Bahamas hit by Hurricane Dorian. Thank you very much, Vanessa, and continue the good work.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart.
We could cover municipal elections around the world every day on this show if we wanted to. You'd be bored. But there's nothing boring about what's going on with Moscow city elections right now. People in Moscow have gotten used to riot police and baton sticks this summer. The unrest started when Kremlin officials barred candidates from running for mayor, candidates who oppose President Vladimir Putin. They were barred because their paperwork wasn't in order, so claim government officials. That's why when Muscovites head to the ballot box this weekend, some 200 names will be missing from the ballot. To help us make sense of all this, we turn to Charles Maines in Moscow. What do you see in the city right now, Charles? Are people gearing up for this big vote?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're looking around the city, you see all these nicely drawn get-out-the-vote posters around town, kind of showing hipsters in parks, holding cappuccinos, smartphones. I guess I would say highlighting some of the more attractive aspects of changes in Moscow over the past several years. But if you go online, it's a little bit different. There's a pro-Kremlin political ad that's been making the rounds, and it warns that if liberal opposition types win races, something else will happen.
All right, I understood the word patriot in there. What is this about?
Right, so this is saying that patriots, if they don't come out and vote, Moscow will suddenly see gay pride parades, gender-fluid students in high school, and of course, the U.S. Navy riding gunships up the Moscow River. So, you know, basically, it's this kind of greatest hits of wedge issues that the Kremlin has built its brand of conservative politics around in recent years.
So this summer, it's been full of protests in Moscow and arrests across the city. Remind us how that actually happened.
The thing that really sparked the movement was the police response to these protests. We had 2,500 arrests, protesters beat by baton-wielding Oman security forces, a lot of really ugly scenes captured on social media. And it seemed to draw others into the movement. And I want to play a little bit of an interview I did with a young student named Andre, who I talked to as police were moving in on a square in central Moscow.
We hope for the liberation of Russia from these people. We want peace and liberation for our city. We just can't step aside.
You know, and a lot of people I talked to seem to feel like Andre. So suddenly we have 60,000 people out to protest, including a lot of people who weren't that interested in the elections, and people like rappers and YouTube stars saying that people had to come out. And so in a way, I guess it's turned this whole election, which most people weren't paying a whole lot of attention to, into something much bigger, this test of political freedoms in Russia today.
Now, the majority of the opposition, we should mention, has spent a good part of the summer in jail. And of course, they're banned from participation. I think of Lyubov Sobol, Alexei Navalny, the main opposition leader, his right-hand woman, who not only was jailed, but was on a hunger strike. Who can people vote for on Sunday? What are their options if they don't want to vote for anybody associated with United Russia?
Well, the opposition is out of the race, but they're influencing what happens here immensely. Just months ago, before all this started, Alexei Navalny, arguably again the leader of the opposition, unveiled a plan called Smart Voting.
Привет, это Навальный, и сейчас я расскажу вам, как мы будем побеждать Единую Россию на выборах.
So the idea here is that Navalny really knew that opposition candidates would likely be banned, and so he's urging people to identify whatever other candidate has the best chance to beat people tied to United Russia or to the mayor or to Vladimir Putin, in other words, the ruling Kremlin parties.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I mean, what if the candidate is a non-democratic nationalist far-right person?
And that's the problem, right? So you ask a liberal Democrat to vote for, say, a communist or a Stalinist or a nationalist, and that's a hard sell. But you know, on the other hand, if you do the math, Navalny's strategy is sound. It would be a way to beat United Russia. It's an extremely unpopular party right now.
What do protesters really want at this point, Charles?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of them want justice for those who are wrongly imprisoned. And certainly those appeals are going forward in the courts here, although I think many people expect it'll take the European Court of Human Rights, of which Russia is a member, to actually get some kind of justice for those who were imprisoned this week. In terms of Sunday, I think, of course, we're looking, will this Navalny smart vote strategy work? It's a real open question. There was a raid on Navalny's headquarters. Again, this seems to happen every other couple weeks, but they raided it again last night, which suggests that authorities are nervous about this plan. We've also seen Kremlin pressure, presumably against candidates that were polling well against these pro-Kremlin candidates and forcing them to drop out of the race. So, you know, but if it does work, what'll happen? Will we see vote rigging like we did back in 2011? Or will, in fact, United Russia basically bow out of politics here on the local level?
Charles Maines in Moscow, reporting on the upcoming Moscow city elections this weekend. As always, Charles, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Times are changing in Europe. I'm not talking about economics or immigration patterns. I'm talking about how people sip their drinks. The European Union is banning single-use plastic straws beginning in 2021. Some American cities and companies like Starbucks are ditching them too. Plastic straws are hard to recycle, and they can wind up floating in our oceans. Straws make up only about 4% of the plastic waste at sea, but they're an easy target, and the anti-straw movement is spurring some creative solutions. Reporter Adeline Sia toured some French cafes to check them out.
At Café des Tribunaux in Dieppe, Normandy, customers are crowding the terrace. Noelia Sanchez and her two daughters are sipping drinks through the horror, plastic straws. Sanchez says she can't wait for bars and cafes to get rid of plastic. I already use cardboard straws at home, and I'd like to buy bamboo one, she says. A straw is a luxury, she says. There's no real need for it, and it takes so long for a plastic one to break down. The owner of this cafe, Alain de Poilly, says he still uses plastic straws, as many as 100,000 a year, in part because they're cheaper. But he wants to switch to something else as soon as possible. We need to find the right product, he says. Cardboard is not good because it falls apart too quickly. And steel is not adequate for repeated use in bars and restaurants because it's hard to clean. De Poilly says he may turn to a farmer in Normandy who's getting into the straw business, making them out of real straw. Farmer Mike Salah says he and his partners recognize they didn't create anything new. We just updated an ancestral tradition, he says. At the end of the harvest, farmers would drink freshly pressed apple juice using straws to avoid sipping the apple residue. He says his organic rye straws have no discernible taste, they're sturdy, even dishwasher safe, and they last about 2 weeks before they start to disintegrate. Salah says he also plans to produce sticks for lollipops and cotton swabs. He says the harvest was a good one this year, and they hope to make 6 to 10 million organic straws to sell everywhere in France and beyond. This summer, most Paris bars and restaurants opted for cornstarch straws, but at least one went for something different. At a café on Place de la République, my drink came with an uncooked hollow noodle, a long ziti serving as a straw. It didn't get soggy, and I didn't notice any pasta flavor. A new use for an unbaked ziti. Happy slurping. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
Coming up, we look back at the legacy of African strongman Robert Mugabe. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Imagine a United States where George Washington went rogue. a heroic founder of a country who then robbed his people and murdered his rivals. Just wonder how he'd be remembered. The people of Zimbabwe and Southern Africa don't have to. They're wrestling with an exact dilemma today as they mark the death of Robert Mugabe. Several Zimbabweans share their thoughts with the BBC, starting with this combat veteran who fought with Mugabe to liberate the nation.
We have lost a former hero of our country who stood up for the liberation of our country and the other oppressed people of the world.
He led Zimbabwe in the right way. We say may his soul rest in peace. He could do the right thing. Although in some things, he did the things not in a good way.
Robert Mugabe, he is the founding father of Zimbabwe. He is viewed as an icon of the nation, and there is going to be sorrow in the country.
Mugabe led the fight for freedom against white colonial rule in the Rhodesia of the 1970s. But after the country became Zimbabwe, he turned into a dictator. For almost 40 years, robbing the country's treasury, he trashed the economy of what was once one of the most prosperous nations in Africa. Newspaper editor Wilf Mbanga knew Mugabe well.
He started off as a great leader, but unfortunately, the way he ended, you know, he will be remembered not for what he did at the beginning, but for what he did towards the end of his life. He was a liberator. He was an icon. It was true. He was all these things. There were many people who died at Mugabe's instigation. I mean, it died because of what Mugabe, just to keep Mugabe in power.
Wilf Mbanga himself suffered at Mugabe's hands and spent 15 years in exile.
I had a very good relationship with him when I was a young reporter. I used to travel with him around the world. And I also remember him for his cruelty towards me in particular and the number of people who have died because of his obsession with power. So, you know, it's with mixed feelings. I still have that warm feeling towards him, but also I hate what he's done for my country, you know, to the people, to the economy, to our health system. It's ironic that he's died in a foreign country seeking medical attention because he destroyed our health system in Zimbabwe.
Finally, just 2 years ago, Robert Mugabe was forced out of office. One of his main political rivals, Tendai Biti, is well aware of Mugabe's failures. Today, though, he was more conciliatory.
Robert Mugabe was the product of a certain era, an era that confronted the colonial regime blow for blow. So violence came naturally to him. So his legacy shouldn't be detracted by the fact that there were atrocities committed. I think today we must mourn Robert Mugabe and pass condolences to his wife and his children and thank him for leading the battle against colonialism and for the emancipation of Zimbabwe.
Robert Mugabe died this morning. He was 95. From Zimbabwe, we move to its neighbor, South Africa, which right now is gripped by violence. Rioters around Johannesburg have been looting businesses and torching shops. Their target? Immigrants from other African countries. At least 10 people have been killed. Several African nations are discouraging travel now to South Africa. And in Nigeria, as payback, protesters have looted South African-owned businesses. My colleague Milton Nkosi with the BBC spoke with us from Johannesburg. He says people there are upset because they think foreigners are stealing their jobs.
The unemployment rate here is at about 28%. And amongst the young people between the ages of 18 and 34, it is hovering around 54%.
Wow.
So there is huge pressure in South Africa in terms of unemployment. Young people are unemployed. Graduates are unemployed. The economy is very sluggish. And that is where the bulk of the anger and frustration is coming from.
And yet the country's police minister has denied that these are xenophobic attacks.
There is certainly a xenophobic problem in South Africa, but a lot of the people who are being attacked are people who own shops. Those are the people who are, by and large, receiving the wrath of this senseless violence. So within context, you can see why the police minister is reluctant to say that this is xenophobic, because there are many other foreigners who are not experiencing the xenophobic attacks.
So this violence is happening in the foreground while the World Economic Forum is taking place in South Africa in the background. It's wrapping up today. What does it have to do with the attacks? Anything?
So the attacks have created, as you can imagine, a huge embarrassment for the South African government. They have had to deal with this very public embarrassment of violence and pillaging and police having to shoot rubber bullets, tear gas, stun grenades to disperse the mobs. Now, when South Africa was under apartheid, a lot of the anti-apartheid activists had to escape apartheid South Africa, and they were hosted across the African continent. So the people who are in government now, Marco, are incredibly ashamed of the fact that their own citizens are attacking people who come from the countries that hosted them in the dark days of apartheid.
Well, we've seen this back and forth between officials in South Africa and in Nigeria, beginning with Nigeria pulling out of the World Economic Forum. And in Nigeria, looters are going after South African-owned businesses. Why the tension between South Africa and Nigeria in particular? Like, what's the context?
So there has been a long-standing rivalry between South Africa and Nigeria just by the virtue of the sizes of their economy. They are competing for the leadership space on the continent. And that rivalry was fun. It was cultural. It was economic. But now it has literally been directly connected to this deadly violence, which is a shame because the president announced that yesterday that there were 10 people who had died and none of them were Nigerians and only two out of the 10 were foreigners.
So in addition to attacks on some foreign nationals, I have to ask you this. August was the deadliest month for women in South Africa, a series of brutal attacks with women being the main targets. There are protesters I know on the streets of Cape Town speaking against this. How does that figure into the other violence, or is it a separate story?
What had happened is that a first-year university student was murdered near Cape Town, and that created a national outcry. Last year alone, nearly 4,000 women and children were murdered in South Africa. This is an unacceptably high number for a country of the size of South Africa.
Massive unemployment, xenophobia run amok, women being attacked. What's the mood in South Africa right now?
The mood this week was pretty grim. And remember, South Africa is still recovering from the legacy of white minority rule. There's still huge poverty here along racial lines. Largely, black people are poor, uneducated, and battling. And largely, the minority white people who form about 10% of the demographic here are more middle class and doing much better. Not all of them, of course, and not all black people are poor, but that's generally the picture if you look from a distance. And all those frustrations, including immigration and gender-based violence and the economy, sluggish economic growth, all of that just came into a confluence of frustration this week.
The BBC's Milton Nkosi in Johannesburg, here on The World. Coming up on The World.
For England is not flag or empire, it's not money, it's not blood, it's limestone gorge and granite fell. It's
songs of Brexit.
Blackbird singing from the May tree, lark ascending through the scales, Robin watching from your spade, an English earth beneath your nails.
That's still ahead here on The World. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is dead in his ditch. The words of Andrew Adonis from the UK's House of Lords. He was riffing on Boris Johnson's own quote this week, that he would rather be dead in a ditch than ask for a Brexit delay. The House of Lords passed the final stage of a bill today that prevents Johnson from leaving the European Union without a Brexit deal. And so this prompted Adonis to call the Prime Minister dead, politically speaking, that is.
Though I don't relish the prospect, because I think it could lead to a third prime minister in as many months, I think that may be the best thing for the country rather than going over the edge of a cliff with Boris Johnson.
The political maneuvering has been hard to follow for folks here in the US, but the same is true for Brits. The city of Portsmouth is on the front lines of Brexit's impact in the UK economy. The World's Orla Barry joins us from Portsmouth, and you're at the ferry terminal, Orla?
I am at the ferry terminal mainly because something like 60% of produce coming through Portsmouth comes from France and Spain. And really what a lot of the people are concerned about is how goods are going to get through various ports and how traffic, etc., is going to be delayed. The motorway is literally just outside, and if you get over 13 trucks lined up coming onto the port, and if they're delayed for any reason, which they will be with the new customs checks, that will back onto the motorway. If it backs onto the motorway, you're talking about major traffic jams.
Yeah, seriously consequential for the city. I mean, Portsmouth is the second largest port in the UK and relies on its connections to Europe and the world, and yet a majority of people there, I understand, voted for Brexit to leave. Why?
Yes, talking to anyone, they said immigration was the reason that they did so. People said that they weren't happy with the number of people they saw coming in from Europe and from other countries, and there was that sense that there wouldn't be enough jobs for local people, and this is their reason for voting for it. It kind of comes down to some simple reasons, I guess, in the end.
Right, so since 2015 and the Brexit vote, has Brexit had an impact in Portsmouth?
It has. I mean, it's actually interesting. I was chatting to one gentleman who is from the Portsmouth Bangladesh Business Association, Raja Ali, because he deals with EU funds and managing EU funds for students who are coming into Portsmouth, because lots of students come to the UK from France and Spain. And have a listen to what he said.
We've had to make the very difficult decision of setting up an office in the Republic of Ireland. And three offices will probably amalgamate into just one small office in the UK, in Portsmouth. And majority of the funding, majority of the students, they will all go to the Republic of Ireland.
So he's moving his business, part of his business, to Ireland. Now, you know, it wasn't what I expected. We've heard of some quite big companies considering moving their offices to Ireland. I didn't expect someone who's, you know, working on a slightly smaller scale to consider moving to Ireland, but that's before Brexit has even happened. And he said that he has talked to many MPs and local councillors and asked them what he should do, and they all asked him to wait and hold on, and he said he just couldn't.
Yeah, already dealing with the practical downsides of Brexit.
Yeah.
What have people in Portsmouth made of the last few days and these stormy speeches in Parliament?
Yeah, I think they've been as aghast and as bewildered as most of the people on the other side of the Atlantic here. It's playing out every day on TV screens here, and no one fully knows what to make of everything that has happened. Funnily enough, I was talking to a Conservative councillor, and I said to him, how does he feel that his own party leader, the Prime Minister, that his own brother doesn't feel that he can stand by him?
Sure, it's going to make for some awkward Christmases in that family, isn't it? I mean, look, there's a lot of tensions in the party and in the country and a lot of differences. Now, I think we just need to get it over with and done, and hopefully we can move on, because all the uncertainty and all the continuing tension thing is not making anything any better.
So there you have it, an awkward Christmas dinner for them. So that's the kind of, you know, overall people are exhausted and bewildered, as they have been for the last 3 and a bit years now, but also the prospect of a general election doesn't mean that it's going to sort things out anytime soon. So that means the bewilderment and frustration will continue.
The World's Orla Barry speaking with us from Portsmouth at the ferry terminal. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Marco.
The British folk trio, the Young'uns, stopped by our studios recently.
Well, the mist was lifting from Rosebery Topping and the moors were cold and green.
Sean Cooney, Michael Hughes, and David Eagle are the Young'uns. Following in the footsteps of great topical folk musicians, the Young'uns joined us to speak and sing about Brexit and what it means to be British, starting with their tune, Gafoor's Bus.
It's the road with a million mouths to fill. It's beans and rice and beans, and a hand when you fall. For there's a friendly face, a better place, and a future for us all.
Sean Cooney of the Young'uns wrote Gafoor's Bus after hearing the story of a real guy, Gafoor Hussain.
He is an incredible, huge-hearted man who lives where we do in the north of England. And for the past 4 years, he's fed thousands and thousands of people all over Europe, refugees and migrants, the homeless and the vulnerable. And he feeds them rice and beans from the back of a converted bus. He's just an amazing humanitarian hero.
Now in Dunkirk we remember yet the soldiers on the sand. 800 ships we'll not forget that came to lend a hand. But here comes one more vessel now across the angry sea to serve 3,000 meals a day and 10,000 cups of tea. It's beans and rice and beans, and a hand when you fall. For there's a friendly face, a better place, and a future for us all.
That was gorgeous. What a great tribute to Gafur.
Thank you very much indeed. It's such a pleasure to sing it.
It occurs to me that some of your lyrics might escape a younger audience. You referenced the boys on the beach in Dunkirk. That would have been World War II and the boats that came to their rescue. For you, I suspect that referencing Dunkirk is referring to a time of this communal spirit when those ships, that flotilla, went to rescue
those.
That's
right, and I think it's incredibly important to do that because Dunkirk, in many ways, is patriotic British people really adhere to and everything that's happening about Brexit in the last few years in the UK, the Dunkirk and the sort of wartime spirit does get brought back and is often used as a patriotic kind of flag-waving thing. But for us to have Dunkirk in the context of someone who was born in Pakistan, who came to Britain, who did amazing things and helped people and became part of the Dunkirk spirit, I think is quite...
And that is Gafur Hussain.
That's right.
Yeah. It segues great into a song called A Place Called England, which is a song that you did not write. I'm curious, is it coincidental that it's the first song on the CD, it came out post-Brexit, and again, does it bemoan a kind of lost England or an England that has lost its social empathy? I mean, you talk about Room for All in it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful song. It was actually written in 1999. It's a song that's 20 years old. It was written by Maggie Holland. But many of the issues have come even more to the fore now in the last couple of years in the UK. Yeah, it's a song that has many individual references to great heroic stories in British history. It's a song about welcome. It's a song about earth. It's a song about the land. It's not a song about flags or money. It's a song about England as a piece of earth, really. I think the style that we sing it in is bold and in your face, but I think we always like to ask questions with the songs rather than sort of stamping any politics or beliefs, but sometimes it's hard not to just have a little dig in there. So there's a reference in there to a rich landowner. He can stay in the Virgin Isles, and that's not a comment on anybody from the Virgin Isles. It's a comment about offshore tax funds,
right? Panama Papers, and all of that.
That's right. So it's hard not to throw in little sort of political digs where you can. But
this idea as well of is people say, well, this is my country and I want it back, and that's often very a white centric, patriotic kind of mindset. And it's our idea of we live in this country as well, and these are our core values, and this is, if we're going to say we're patriotic, this is why, because of our rich social history of inclusion, rather than this kind of building an empire and saying this is mine and you're not welcome and get out. And so we almost, that idea of reappropriating this idea of this is our country, make Britain great and that kind of thing.
What's fascinating for me, being an ex-history student and looking into these things a lot recently, is how patriotism has been almost completely lost in the left wing of politics, certainly in Britain.
It's kind of become love of country is almost nationalistic, and that's a bad thing.
That's right. Yeah. Whereas you look at the men and women who went to fight against fascism in the Spanish Civil War, against the wishes of the government, they were patriotic. They called themselves the proud sons of Britain. Mm. They were doing it for national pride as well. It's a really interesting thing that I think has been lost somewhat.
Well, we will end then with a song with some questions and a few barbs. A Place Called England is the title.
Sorry, that's the most wordy song that we've done. Here we go.
Barbs. Anyway, right.
They said you guys had a sense of humor, and indeed you do. Well, Sean Cooney, David Eagle, Michael Hughes, thank you very much.
Thank you, my friend.
I
rode out on a bright May morning like a hero in a song, looking for a place called England, trying to find where I belong. Couldn't find the old flood meadow or the house that I once knew, no trace of the little river or the garden where I grew.
Check out our exclusive video, The Young'uns, performing in the studio here. You can watch it at theworld.org.
Paul Manston outside the gate. Retail park and Burger Kingdom, prairie field and factory farm, run by men who think that England's just a place to park their car.
It's not a milestone anyone wants to reach. The number of people infected with the deadly Ebola virus has now hit 3,000 in Central Africa. The majority of those cases have been in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in an outbreak that began just more than a year ago. As if that wasn't bad enough, the region is now also suffering from a deadly outbreak of measles. Dr. Nahid Bedelia has spent her career working on Ebola. She heads the Special Pathogens Unit at Boston Medical Center and was recently at the Ugandan border training health workers there. She spoke with my colleague, the world's Carol Hills.
Dr. Bedelia, what's it like where you were along the Ugandan border? Describe the scene for us.
In one of the areas where I was at, they had just seen some suspect cases, and healthcare workers there, they still sort of took a deep breath before they went in, you know, to start taking care of that patient because they have all the tools. They've been told they have the vaccine now. Many of them have been vaccinated. But it is still that question, this fear of, am I ready to do this, you know, and what does it mean for my family to take care of Ebola patients, and what will it mean for me and for this patient?
So once in the treatment center, how long does a patient typically stay?
If they came in early into care, generally, a patient may stay for about a month. If they came in later in their disease, it depends on how vulnerable they were to that disease. They may pass away within 5 days, 4 days. So the way I always think about infectious diseases is their capacity to cause havoc on communities, the three parts to that. One is the disease itself. How easily is it transmitted? The other is the person. How vulnerable are you to succumbing to this disease? How good is your immune system, your nutrition? And the third is health systems. How good are the health systems at finding you when you're sick and bringing you to care? And what we're seeing with DRC, right, we just crossed the 3,000 number. And the interesting thing is, you know, I'd worked in the West Africa epidemic as well. And when that epidemic happened with the 28,000 cases, you know, and the thought was that's a black swan event. We had never seen Ebola do this. And now here we are again, another outbreak where there's thousands of cases. And so how can a disease that's so hard to transmit, believe it or not, it is, compared to measles or some of the other diseases, it's not airborne. And so why is this happening? You know, particularly now in this DRC outbreak, we're much better off than we were in West Africa. We have a vaccine that we think works. We have now treatments that if you come early to care, your mortality with this disease that we've thought is 70% or 80% in the past can go down to 6%.
And what do you think the answers to those questions are?
Because most people aren't coming to care.
Why is that?
One aspect is in this part of the Democratic Republic of Congo in North and South Kivu, as you know, there is a long history of political upheaval, and there are about 100 armed groups sort of operating, have been operating. And so getting access to populations in that setting and doing safely so and having healthcare workers present and ensuring their safety has been difficult. The other is trust. People don't want to come to a community health center with something that looks like malaria and then be taken away to another unit that they don't recognize.
Are there changes going on the ground about how to deal with this current outbreak?
Measles, since it started, the outbreak started in January for measles, 161,000 people have gotten measles, and over 3,000 people have died of it in the same area of DRC.
Cholera. As Ebola?
Yes. In cholera, 15,000 people have gotten sick, right? Almost 300 people have died. And so look at this from the perspective of someone who is in one of those communities in Democratic Republic of Congo. They're saying, why are you so concerned with Ebola when we're dying of everything else? And so the strategy, I think, which I believe a lot of organizations are sort of looking to address, is one that's more comprehensive.
Is there a moment that really sticks with you from your recent visit to the Ugandan border?
I think the moment was walking into an Ebola treatment unit and finding all these healthcare workers there that have been taking care of suspect cases that have come through the border, and just seeing this just look of complete both exhaustion, but also, you know, this sense of pride of that we're doing, you know, hard work that's important.
That was Dr. Nahid Bedelia with Boston Medical Center speaking with my colleague Carol Hills. Today, the leaders of several South American nations that border the Amazon are convening. Their goal, find a way to protect the Amazon from deforestation after a summer of brutal forest fires. We spoke with tropical ecologist Paulo Brando in Brazil. He's with the University of California, Irvine. In Brazil, he was surrounded by a lot of birds. That will make sense in a bit. Paulo explained first why scientists are concerned that forest fires may get more frequent and intense.
What we saw in 2019 that was very different is an increase in deforestation and then people piling up all that forest and burning, creating the biggest bonfires over the past 10 years. And with climate change and more frequent droughts, those deforestation fires are more likely to escape and burn standing forests. And that can increase the damage caused by the deforestation fires by several orders of magnitude.
You know, I remember in the 1990s, the Globe was very attentive to the Amazon. The rock star Sting was championing the cause. We had Ben and Jerry's Rainforest Crunch ice cream, which with proceeds going to protecting the Amazon. How did we get to this point where the future of the rainforest seems to be in greater doubt than ever?
I would say that we had some of the worst periods in the Amazon in the late 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. But then we also had this wind of hope from 2008 to 2014, when deforestation rates in the Brazilian Amazon decreased by 70%. And that was a very positive message, a message that with governance, we can reduce deforestation, forest degradation, and increase food production. Right now, what is very scary is that in a moment that the Amazon is becoming more vulnerable to climate change, more vulnerable to fires, we are increasing the number of fires in the region and accelerating deforestation once again. And this is what is very different about 2019.
It seems a big part of the problem here is land clearing for agriculture and mining. How should private companies, do you think, be brought into the loop and be regulated more effectively?
So this is a very important point, right? Because in the Amazon, there are several causes for deforestation. And one of them is land grabbing in public lands, lands that have no clear designation. A lot of deforestation in the Amazon right now is happening in those areas. And just to create a specific land use for those areas is already a huge step forward to avoid deforestation in the region. Now, what is happening outside protected areas and those no man's land is very important because those private properties usually produce food and beef that are sold to international markets. And when this happens, it's very important that those companies are very aware where the beef or soybean are coming from. And what happened in 2008 that was very special is that a lot of these companies, they decided not to buy from the forested areas. So the private sector said, we are going to try to follow the law.
And what are the consequences if countries do not take decisive action?
What we can say is that we know that there are some mechanisms by which fire, droughts, deforestation, forest fragmentation can turn the forest into something else that is not a forest, is not a savanna, it is a highly degraded system with lower capacity to function and produce rainfall. And the more we clear forest, degrade the system, change the climate regionally but also globally, we get closer and closer and closer to that tipping point.
Paulo Brando is a tropical ecologist and professor at the University of California, Irvine, as well as a researcher at the Woods Hole Research Center. Speaking with us from Brasilia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fashion giant Christian Dior is in hot water. Its commercial with Johnny Depp is steeped in Native American themes. The ad is for a fragrance called Sauvage, that's French for savage or untamed. The World's Rupa Shenoy tells us why this has not gone over so well.
In this short advertisement slash film released by Dior, Johnny Depp, looking grungy in a poncho, walks and plays the guitar around Arches National Park in Utah, which looks a lot like the Grand Canyon. There are flashes of a dancer in traditional dress spinning at the top of an outcropping, and a young woman in a bearskin seemingly spies on Depp. He never sees her.
We are the land. The new Sauvage, le parfum. Dior
released the film online, describing the fragrance as, quote, an authentic journey deep into the Native American soul. The reaction was almost immediate. Leah Salgado is managing director of Illuminative, a nonprofit devoted to increasing the visibility of Native people.
I think fashion is this weird place where they see themselves as above, right, everything else.
People criticize the name, Sauvage, because the word savage has historically been used to denigrate Native people. They said the image of the young woman in a bearskin played on old stereotypes of the sexualized Native maiden, which is especially insensitive now as Native communities are struggling to bring attention to an epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And then there's Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp is problematic.
She points to Depp's portrayal of Tonto in Disney's The Lone Ranger in 2013. The character is shirtless, tattooed, with white face paint, and a dead crow on his head.
Or says you are a spirit walker.
It was a movie that was so racist that Native actors and crew members walked off the set. There are a lot of negative feelings, I think, about his role in that movie.
Depp has claimed some Native heritage himself. He hasn't responded to the criticism of the Dior film. Dior did, though.
Initially, what they started to do was delete negative comments from their social media, and then they pulled their social media. But they still went forward with their launch party that was full of, like, really harmful Native tropes.
But Dior had taken steps to make sure it was being culturally sensitive. It worked with a group called Americans for Indian Opportunity, or AIO. That group has since released a statement saying they deeply regret their participation.
A lot of folks want to talk about and focus on AIO's role and the Native people that were involved, but I think ultimately all of that responsibility and all that blowback should be directed towards the company.
Cultural consulting can be a tricky job. Lucas Browneyes is a TV writer, director, and occasional cultural consultant.
There's always that fear, like, oh, what if they do something really offensive? I tell them, they do it anyways, and then they claim they have a consultant because there's nothing really preventing them from doing that.
Many fashion brands have been accused of cultural appropriation, so much so that a group of archaeologists, academics, and Indigenous people created a guide called Think Before You Appropriate. George Nicholas, a professor at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, helped write the guide.
I think that, you know, over time we are going to see those large companies become, I hope, more aware of, you know, the consequences of their action, more aware that they need to be cognizant of all of the cases, all of the controversies that have come before them.
But, he says, these are big, mainstream, multinational, billion-dollar companies, and it takes time for them to change. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
And that will take care of business for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio, I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a relaxing weekend.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.